What we did was we took a laptop, pried off the top of it, and we made little red flags out of toothpicks, red cellophane, and we glued them to every part of the machine that represented intellectual property of another company. The irony of it is, at about 100 and some odd, we ran out of room for more flags. So we took this basically flag-draped laptop into his office and propped it on his desk and said, here's why we need the license. He got the point immediately, and we were then off to the races.
Hello, I'm Bruce Berman, the host of Understanding IP Matters, a podcast series that looks at the impact of intellectual property rights on people and business. Season 3 spotlights such topics as artificial intelligence, IP licensing, and TikTok as a learning tool. Enjoy the episode. Today, Understanding IP Matters has the honor of presenting a very special guest, IP Hall of Famer Marshall Phelps. For those who may not know him, a little background. He has pioneered many of IP's most successful strategies. In the 1990s, as vice president of IP business and licensing at IBM, his group generated as much as $2 billion annually. Amazing for a company that in 1992 was a hairbreadth away from bankruptcy. Prior to IP, he was director of government relations for IBM and established the company's Asia-Pacific headquarters in Tokyo. In 2003, Marshall was personally recruited by Bill Gates to head Microsoft's IP business. Marshall was instrumental in the software maker's emergence as one of the most successful IP-focused businesses. He has taught IP strategy at business, law, or engineering schools at Cornell, USC, Duke, UC Berkeley, and in Japan. In 2006, he was elected to the initial class of the Intellectual Property Hall of Fame. Welcome, Marshall, and where are you speaking from this beautiful fall day?
I am in Greenwich, Connecticut, in my house, and it is beautiful.
You're about 10 miles, 20 minutes from where I live in Westchester, so it's kind of ironic that we're that close. You retired from IBM in 2003 after 28 years and enormous success. What brought you out of a very active retirement?
When I first left IBM, I was in the venture capital world for a couple of years. And this is actually a true story. I was committing one of the worst rules that you can break at a country club. I was playing golf when my cell phone rang. And it was Bill Gates. And he wanted me to come out to Redmond, Washington and meet with him and see if there's anything that I could do to perhaps help them break out of their situation and kind of join the rest of the world and use intellectual property to make that happen. He's hard to say no to. And so I got on an airplane and flew out there and we met. And it was obvious to me they were quite clueless on what to do with intellectual property. But what they were doing wasn't nearly enough. So it made sense for me to give it a shot.
What was it like working with Gates?
Bill Gates was terrific. He was a huge ally of doing all this stuff. His dad, who was then alive, who was a fine lawyer, understood this stuff immediately. And I had lunch with him, I don't know, four or five times over the course of the time I was out there, trying to explain to his dad what we were trying to do. And that was all very collegial. The problem with most of these situations is it's not the CEO that's the problem. It's the organization that's the problem. I suppose my lesson number one is you have to do as much work inside as you have to do outside to convince the colonels and the captains and the majors that this makes sense for them as well. That is an issue that is constant and continues to this day. I mean, you sell things and then you sell them again. And so that was kind of the situation.
And you have to sell it internally as well as externally.
That's my point. It's actually as hard to do internally as it is externally. By the way, if you don't sell it internally, nothing else matters. It'll be death by a thousand cuts. And I know this because one of the things that I did in between the two companies was become a consultant to Jack Welch at GE. And on the same subject, how can GE use its immense intellectual property resources? Well, the problem with GE is it's more of a federation than it was a single company. And Jack could issue all the edicts he wants, but if the organizations don't want to do it, it doesn't matter. And in this particular GE case at the time, the aircraft people had absolutely no interest in helping any other part of the business other than themselves. And the other parts of the business kind of felt similar. So even with a task force headed by, at that point, by Jeff Immelt and myself, we got absolutely nowhere. So my point is, I'm not picking on GE for any particular reason. I'm just making the point that you have to sell it internally as much as you do externally.
In 1992, Marshall, IBM was getting ready to file Chapter 11, is my understanding. What role did IP rights play in getting the company back on track?
Well, the timing is subject to some debate, but IBM, I think, was down to 100 days of cash in that period. And I took this job just a little before that. I really didn't have a boss because John Akers had left the CEO slot and Lou Gerstner hadn't arrived yet, which gave me some degrees of freedom that I'd never get again. You got to kind of organize things as you wanted to organize them. And by the way, we were reasonably successful at doing that. And the question is, what good did that do you? And the answer is, it bought IBM a lot of time. And by the way, it did the same at Microsoft. It gave them something to latch onto while all else was falling apart. IBM went back to being number one in patents in the United States, which IBM had very few good press at about that time. And if you recall, IBM made a big deal out of the fact that it had become number one in patents when the year before we were falling out of the top 10. So we got that. And then we started making a little bit of money. So that's kind of what happened.
IBM rode that top spot, that pony, for 29 years. I think they were the number one file or grantee. In recent years, they've really reduced that number significantly in recent year or two. At IBM, you headed IP business and licensing under at least three CEOs, I believe, no? Or was that two, Akers and Gerstner?
Akers and Gerstner, for sure, yes.
What was that like? How did you introduce Akers and then Gerstner? How did you introduce them to the IP concept or the patent concept?
Well, I mean, Akers understood the patent concept. What he didn't understand was what would you do with it?
Mm-hmm.
It's like that old joke about the dog who chases the car down the street and catches it. And then the question is, okay, now what are you going to do with it? There was really not much understanding of what you could do with it. One of the reasons I took the job was because there was no understanding of what to do with that stuff. I learned that understanding, by the way, when I was in Japan, when I learned about the practical application of comparative advantage. And it occurred to me that software was IBM's comparative advantage in the industry, and we weren't taking advantage of it at all. In fact, other companies were basically stealing it and were struggling with what to do with that. So I took that job, and with John Akers' obvious concurrence, and started working on it. And then John retired, and we were CEO-less for, gosh, I can't tell you how many months, but a pretty good bit of time. And Lou Gerstner arrives. Lou Gerstner arrives, and on day two, I believe, sends me an email and says, "What the hell do you think you're doing? You're licensing our intellectual property to our competitors." He said, "Come and see me immediately." Now, I have to explain something. Lou Gerstner came from Nestle's, which was a cookie manufacturer, and he got into a lawsuit over chocolate chip cookies, a patent lawsuit, at which he lost. And they had to get out of the soft chocolate chip cookie business. So his view of what you do with patents is you stop people, and that was his view. I thought that was an unfortunate view, but that was his. So I was sitting around with Bart Eppenauer and a couple of guys one night saying, how the hell are we going to convince this guy in 38 seconds, which is about all he had, that he needed to license because he needs to license as much as he needs to license other people. But what we did was we took a laptop. They look just like they do now, even back then, and pried off the top of it. And we made little red flags out of toothpicks and red cellophane, and we glued them to every part of the machine that represented intellectual property of another company. The irony of it is, at about 100 and some odd, we ran out of room for more flags. So we took this basically flag-draped laptop into his office and propped it on his desk and said, here's why we need the license. Not being stupid at all, he got the point immediately, and we were then off to the races. And the good second part about that is he left us alone, and that really started to work. The second great event that proved the point was the semiconductor business, which was changing technologies at that time. And it was going to a more manufacturable, if you will, less expensive technology versus the very sophisticated kind. And they had all these engineers who were out of work or going to be out of work. And I went to see a guy by the name of Mike Attardo, who was president of that division. And I said, Mike, if you give me 25 engineers and fund me for a couple of electron microscopes, I'll make you a bunch of money. And he did. And in the first year, we made him $25 million. Why? Because we could prove infringement of the way we were doing things by the technologies of the other companies. But we had to use electron beam microscopes and people who actually knew what they were looking at, which didn't include me. But it worked famously. And once you have a division that is seeing money come in from doing something like that, other divisions tend to want to follow and say, why not me? And so we were pretty much off to the races. But it goes back to the point I was making. You have to convince these divisions that it's in their interest to do it, because their instincts are that they own the intellectual property, not the company. So we went back to Lou Gerstner and said, look, we're having a little trouble here. We can't convince some of these divisions that we can do it better than they can, because they want to do it on their own and they think they own this stuff. So I think it was probably Lou's first email. He sends an email to every employee in the company and basically said, lest there be any doubt, intellectual property is owned by the corporation, not by the division. And all decisions about the disposition of intellectual property reside with intellectual property and licensing, which is, of course, my particular function at the time. And so once that happened, now we were really off to the races, because there was no debate about it anymore. But having said that, you have to resell that about every year. And that's what we were able to do. And we did it by an accounting change. We didn't want to give the money to the divisions that we were taking it. We wanted that to go to the corporation. But we had to figure out how to give the divisions a credit for what they did. And it was worth it, because they were helping us in a way too. This way, it was part of their measurement system. They got attaboys and attagirls for doing it, and the company made money, and everybody won.
And this is pretty high margin revenue, I would imagine.
Well, at the end, we were making $2 billion a year, and it was costing me $36 million to do it.
That's high margin.
That's real high margin. And it makes you very popular with the financial guys, to the point they used to call me every year and say, what more do you need? Which is an unlikely phone call to get in corporate America.
And this is like the 1990s primarily, right?
That's the whole decade of the 90s, yeah.
Yeah, that was the heyday. IBM Marshall had the confidence and good fortune to trust R&D to come up with new inventions that businesses wanted. The company was adept at reinventing itself every decade or so. It rarely, if ever, sued anyone who infringed it, made them partners. IBM was an outlier in that regard. Maybe Philips was somewhat similar, but there aren't too many operating companies that have that level of confidence about their inventions.
Not too many companies had a Watson Labs. AT&T did, which they squandered toward the end, which you probably know better than anyone. But not many companies had that capability of kind of regenerating and also funding research in areas they didn't know where the hell they were going.
Right. Had the confidence to take a shot, yeah. And trust the R&D, trust the research people.
Yes, but the risk was that that was coming to an end. When you're down to 100 days in cash, everything is at risk. And I think, fortunately, the company rescued itself right on time. At least that's how I remember it.
You worked with copyrights and trademarks and trade secrets as well. Know-how or consulting, you might call it consulting, I do, is a big part of what IBM was selling. How did IP rights enable the consulting part of IBM?
Well, if you don't have IP rights, of course, you're a high-risk proposition if you're consulting about things that you're building and they're using that and you're not protecting it. By the way, that's exactly the same problem Microsoft had. They wanted to do this kind of work with customers, but they didn't want to stick a document in front of them and say, please sign this, because they thought that would be not well received. there wasn't that small problem. So we spent a lot of time convincing customers that it made sense to do that. Now, how did we do it? One is we didn't turn this over to just lawyers. We had a negotiation about one of these type of things with a customer. We took the researchers with us. And we'd stick the researchers up in front of a whiteboard or a blackboard and said, explain to them what you're working on and why this is important and what's going to come next, that kind of thing. And that's a much better sales call. That was the way we did it. We turned it into a real business proposition, not a legal one necessarily. Obviously, there's a legal component to it, but there was a business proposition to it as well.
Now, at both IBM and Microsoft, a lot of people who worked for you or with you went on to become IP luminaries in their own right. Brian Hinman at Philips, now at Aon. Dan McCurdy, who heads RPX now. He was at Lucent, I believe. Dave Kapos, former USPTO director. Louis Carboneau of Tangible IP. Horacio Gutierrez was formerly GC at Spotify, and now he's GC of Disney. What do you think were the most important lessons these people learned from you?
I think the most important lesson was probably the importance of making this a collaboration within the company first.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the first thing. That I think legal departments have a tendency to be islands of themselves. And then they wonder why they don't have more influence in the company, if you will. Well, the reason is nobody knows them. I think that's the first lesson. So every one of those people that you mentioned was quite adept at working this process, at talking to people and all that, getting in bed with finance people and say, here's why we're doing this, because every year the finance people changed and you'd get the same arguments, why are we doing this, that kind of stuff. But they learned that they had to do that first. That's true in every single case of the guys you mentioned.
Patents today are, especially those that cover software and business methods and other inventions, are more uncertain and difficult to enforce than ever.
Yes.
What can businesses do to swing the pendulum back to a more 1990s-like environment?
I think looking at the world from the prospect of enforcement only is too narrow. You have to convince the licensees they're doing this for their own good. That in a sense, you're doing their R&D for them. And all this is a cheaper way for them getting the product, if you will, than if they had to start from scratch and do it themselves and then run the risk of litigation or something down the road. It's really not that hard to convince people that, but that's a very hard lesson for people to learn that that's the way they should do it. The forces of nature are stacked against, though, if you think about it. The legal department says, what the hell, will sue the bastards. You know, the finance people say, well, let's close them down, you know, that kind of thing. And if you say, no, I want them to have this and use it, provided a nice little loop back to us on how good the stuff is and all of that. And we'll learn from that too. And our only job is we have to stay one step ahead of them. Boy, that's a risky call to make for people. But if you've got a company like IBM or Microsoft, or there are any numbers of them today, like Adobe, for example, their GC, now EVP, was another guy who worked for me. But if you start from that lesson, people get it, and it works. But you have to keep your foot on your own accelerator, or it won't work. Because they'll lose confidence. And, you know, they'll say, Jesus, go back to Lou Gerstner's first letter to me. You're giving our stuff away. That's the way they would look at that.
They seem to use IP for relationship building. You know, they rarely, if ever, sued anyone. They made partners of people, small and large.
That's basically the Microsoft model now. Now, why did Microsoft have to do it? Well, many of you of a certain age will remember that Microsoft wasn't very popular in the 90s and the first part of the 21st century. And they didn't have partners. They didn't have friends. They had, instead of an outward reaching thing, they had something called a NAP clause that they put in every single contract. What's a NAP clause? Non-assertion of patents. In other words, if you wanted Windows, you signed an agreement that said you won't assert any patents against Windows in the universe. So Fujitsu couldn't sue Hitachi for infringement, you know, that kind of thing. Now, you multiply that times thousands of customers, which Microsoft had, And you've basically put a one-way restriction on the entire industry exercising intellectual property rights, whether they wanted to or not. So, having done that, Microsoft lost a lot of friends. Or, I'll put it another way, didn't get a lot of friends. They needed something to replace that. So we did a complete 180. And we went from that kind of restrictive life to one that says, take this intellectual property and use it. And lo and behold, the results are obvious.
And it extended, I guess, it was after your time, but to the cloud, now that there's a lot of openness with regard to the cloud, although they're certainly able to sell products around it.
It's funny. One of the first meetings that I was in with Bill Gates, it was really funny. He had probably 10 people in the room, and we were discussing new ideas, and he walked in. You got to think back now. This is ways. He walks in, he says, I don't know what it is, but I heard about this thing called the cloud. I think it's going to be important. So we're going to have to work on it. So that was the level that it started. So everybody marched away and started working on the cloud. And it's been very successful for Microsoft since that time.
Despite decades of discussion, Marshall, IP rights are still not really properly reflected on the balance sheet. It's goodwill. It's thrown into goodwill. You know, this discussion has been going on for decades. You know, why has it been so difficult? I know you're interested in that issue. Why has it been so difficult to get IP on the balance sheet, especially patents?
Well, it shouldn't be. I can remember having some meetings with some of the major accounting firms, and the reason they didn't want to do it is they were scared to death of this whole question of how do you value this stuff? And they thought they were going to get sued. So they were, you know, for misvaluing it one way or the other. Like either like Donald Trump because he overvalued buildings as the allegation is, or undervalued it. Either way, you lose. And so the accounting firms, and you know, every big company has an accounting firm, were scared to death of it and still are. So if you pack it away as goodwill, throw a number at it, well, everybody knows that goodwill is really hard to value. So therefore, it might be okay. So that's where it is, and that's where it was, and probably now it ever shall be. I don't know.
If you value it and put it on the balance sheet and it doesn't perform up to value, then you have to write it down. And that's a scary prospect. Yeah.
Well, that's the point. Either way you do it. But when you start making a couple of billion a year doing it and it doesn't show up, that doesn't do very much for the company. It kind of misrepresents how the company is doing well. So you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. My own view of that is that we ought to find a way to do it. And it can't be that impossible. Christ, we value everything else under the sun. But, you know, intellectual property is scary to people who are genetically driven, and so that's where it is.
Well, especially patents, trademarks, there's a market value within a certain range, and probably copyrights too. You can kind of value with all these, you know, record labels and catalogs, but patents get tough unless it's pharma patent, a specific drug.
But you also have to remember with patents that you may get it issued, and it may be 10 years before it's worth anything, and nobody knows when that 10 years start. That kind of stuff. On the other hand, if you're in an industry where the patent equals the product, i.e., take a drug company that invents a new drug and they patent that thing, that patent has almost a one-to-one relationship with the value of the drug. And that one's easy. Now, if I go to a laptop computer here that I'm looking at, and it's got, I don't know, 5,000 patents in it, pick a number. It gets very difficult. Those are kind of the structural reasons, I think.
I think they say there are 100,000 or more patents that comprise an iPhone.
Yeah.
Certainly a lot of licenses are in there. Listeners may not be aware that you were a co-founder of CIPU back in 2016, along with me, Judge Paul Michel, and Jim Pooley. You were a big help in getting it off the ground, and you were a founding member of the board. Are you still active in areas like this, trying to get IP awareness more of a front burner issue?
Well, I go in and out of it. I mean, for a number of years, I I did it kind of from an academic point of view, you know, with the national institutes and things of that nature, and, you know, try to educate people from the ground up. So, yes, I'm still very interested in the subject and all of that. I've turned out to be a terrible retiree. I'm flunking it unbelievably. I wrote a book about my IBM and mostly Microsoft experiences.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Burning of the ships, transforming companies' culture through intellectual property strategy.
Much of the same stuff we've been talking about here.
What's burning of the ships? What's the significance of that title, burning the ships?
When the Spanish decided to take over the local Indians in Mexico and the trade in gold and all that stuff, and they landed their ships, the leader of the expedition had the ships burn so that the sailors and soldiers couldn't return. They had to stay and fight. So the idea was it's kind of irrevocable at that point. And that was the idea behind the switch that Microsoft was making from being a kind of an inward-focused, difficult partner to changing completely around to the opposite model. Once you did that, you can't go back. Which, by the way, is another reason I think some of these changes are hard for people to make, because if they make them and it doesn't work, then they're, you know, then they're up the creek. And I think that risk is one that most businessmen can't articulate and can't basically avoid, so they don't want to do it. I think that's another reason you find this to be not as quickly received as it should be.
We're getting to the end of our time here, Marshall. What two thoughts would you like listeners to remember from today's conversation?
Well, the first one is the main lesson that I learned in corporate America, and not just corporate America. It's because it's kind of a universal truth, is that this is a collaborative industry, and you have to work as hard internally as you do externally to make it work. And you have to keep repeating the damn process annually, because every year is a new plan. And every year is new people. Every year is the new batch of skeptics that you didn't have the year before, and so that's the one thing that most people don't understand. They think you can do this by executive fiat, and you can't. You will fail.
You have to believe in it; otherwise, it doesn't work.
Well, you certainly have to believe in it. There's no question about that. But you can also believe in it and screw it up. I think you have to get other people to believe in it. The way you do that is you change the measurement system, you change the ability of why people want to do it. Going along with this, and I just want to add one thing about this, which may be the second thing, is the other thing that's bemoaned all the time in this industry is, why isn't this issue more important to the board of directors? Why is it that nobody has a seat at the table? Well, the fact is, some do have a seat at the table, but the ones who do are the ones who do the things that I just talked about. They don't force their way on it. They don't do it by executive fiat. They convince the business how important it is to the business, and then you've got a seat at the table. So I would say for anybody who wants to run an organization like this, who gets the opportunity to run an organization like this, you better think in those kinds of terms. And just don't be impatient. Just let it happen.
But can you license patents today the way you could, say, in the 90s when there was respect for an issued patent had some meaning? Now it's just the beginning.
No, I think you can. I really do. But you're onto a good point. And the good point is this. It's always easier if you have a good product. If you don't have a good product, you have a bunch of mishmash patents, nobody cares. But if you have a bunch of good patents and you're still going to do R&D, remember I said take the researchers with you to these meetings? If they think you're going to, maybe I don't need them right now, but I'm going to need them next year kind of thing, you can make this work. And people will want to license it because they want the fruits of the R&D. You're talking about an industry where a chip plant, I was just reading today, the chip plant that Intel is building is going to be about $4 billion. These are not cheap things. And not everybody can do them. So Intel could say, well, we're doing it, therefore we're not going to let you have any of that stuff that comes out of that. Well, that's short-sighted. But if you said, I'm gonna do this, folks, and I would like to be successful at it, and I'd like you to be successful. Then I think you've got a much better argument on your behalf, and I do think you can still do licensing on that basis.
Well, on that note, I think we're out of time, but thank you very much, Marshall. I know you don't do many of these interviews, so we're very fortunate to have you, and it's an honor. And we've known each other over 20 years, and I value our friendship, and I look forward to hearing more from you on these topics. Thank you again.
My pleasure.
Understanding IP Matters is brought to you by the Center for IP Understanding, an independent nonprofit. Follow CIPU on LinkedIn at the Center for Intellectual Property. Content conveyed is for informational purposes only and does not represent the views of CIPU or its affiliates. This episode was produced by Jack Shields for Wild Creek Studios.